Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the story out of Sri Lanka really changed from yesterday morning to this morning. Yesterday at this time, authorities were saying it was a horrific but narrowly focused terrorist attack that was a flare-up of a decades-old local conflict. Now it's being described as an ISIS-linked revenge attack for the mosque massacres in New Zealand. That at least is the word from government officials in Sri Lanka. If true, it suggests a new kind of radical Islamist versus radical white supremacist terrorist war fueled on both sides by global social media networks, with both sides targeting innocent civilians in their houses of worship, from New Zealand to Sri Lanka to Pittsburgh. How does that cycle of violence get ended? There are also questions now about how much the Sri Lankan government knew in advance about the potential for just this sort of attack and failed to act on that intelligence. Joining me now, Washington Post reporter Ishan Tharoor and Alan Keenan, Sri Lanka senior analyst based in London for the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent war and maximize peace. Alan and Ishan, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Ishan, what's your understanding as of now of who was responsible and with what motivations?
Well, Sri Lankan officials have pointed to two local groups operating in Sri Lanka that we really hadn't heard that much about in the past and who we'd never expected could carry out an assault of this scale in the past. There are suggestions of, as you indicated, links to jihadist networks overseas. There are suspicions right now that at least some of these people involved in the attacks, including a number of people that the government has since arrested, made trips overseas. And so we're seeing slowly evidence of some kind of transnational plot, but it's very early at this stage. As you suggested earlier, one cabinet minister has come out and pointed the finger to this broader kind of global conflict, saying that this attack was done as a revenge attack because of New Zealand. But the prime minister today as well was a bit more circumspect, saying that we don't really know yet, but there is a suspicion that those who perpetrated this assault were doing it in this kind of, as you said, really extremist global narrative.
Further to that, I heard an analysis that while the group that is believed to be responsible is an obscure local one, apparently concerned with local conflicts, and that was the going assumption as of yesterday, the nature of the attacks on closer inspection, spectacular, multiple on the same day, aimed directly at churches and higher-end hotels, has all the hallmarks of something more like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Does it look like that to you?
It certainly it seems to be something that was carried out with a degree of sophistication and logistical planning that I'm sure experts like Alan, also on the line, would agree he must have had some kind of external assistance or coordination. But at this point, we don't have enough evidence yet to either prove or disprove these apparent claims of ISIS involvement or some kind of substantive foreign involvement.
Alan Keenan from the International Crisis Group, do you want to jump in on that? It certainly made news this morning when the Sri Lankan health minister said there was an international network without which these attacks could not have succeeded. Do you take that as an established fact or something that seems apparent based on the sophistication of the attacks?
Yeah, I'd say the latter is the way I would put it. I don't think anything is absolutely set yet. I think we all need to keep our skeptical hats on until real hard evidence is presented. But I do think that was the working assumption, is this group, which is known in Sri Lanka, and I've in fact done research where I've met people who have suffered at the hands of National Tawhid Jamaat, some Sufi groups in the eastern town of Katankudi. So we know they're violent. Their rhetoric is extremely violent, and sometimes they take that to physical ways. But But they haven't. There's no evidence ever presented by anybody that suggests they had the capability, the resources, the skill, the training, the networks to pull off an attack like this. So I think it's a logical assumption that if it was this group, if it was this local group that did it, they needed some help from outside. I've just seen a new statement from ISIS, which claims credit and actually has a photograph of the attackers. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't.
Came out, and one of them certainly looks like he could be the leader of the National Tawhid Jamaat, but it's not entirely certain.
Huh.
But it does seem to be pointing more in that direction, I would think.
Alan, this is a majority Buddhist nation with only a 7% Muslim majority and a 6% Catholic minority, from what I've read. Is that about right?
Sorry, say those numbers again. I lost you for a second.
That this is a majority Buddhist nation with only about a 7% Muslim minority and a 6% Catholic minority, according to the numbers I've seen.
Muslims are 10% of the country, according to the latest census.
Okay.
And Catholic, Christians are probably 6 to 8%.
Right.
Most of them Catholics, but there's evangelicals and there's Methodists and a range of others.
So still very small, barely into double digits if it's 10% for Muslims, 6 or 8% for Christians. So in the domestic context, Alan, I'll stay with you on this.
Mm-hmm.
Why would people claiming to represent the 10% minority attack the 8% minority, or is there no domestic context there?
Well, I don't think there's a domestic context which explains that, and I think that is one of the reasons why people are looking outside to a different sort of global level of discourse and violence to explain that. There are tensions within and between Sri Lanka's various communities, and you know those have in some cases been deep. Most recently, there has been a 5 to 6 year sustained campaign against Muslims, against Sri Lanka's Muslims, principally by Sinhalese and Buddhist groups who claim that that quote unquote Muslim extremism and Muslim economic and political power is threatening the Buddhist character of the island. So when I woke up to hearing that there was some, I think the logical response then, if you were to predict violence by Muslims, it would be against Buddhists, not against Christians, because there is no history of tensions between Christians and Muslims. And indeed, evangelical Christians have, like Muslims, come under similar forms of pressure from the same set of Sinhala Buddhist militant groups. So, and indeed, there's actually practices of cooperation between evangelical Christian groups and Muslim groups defending themselves and appealing for justice and protection against such attacks by militant Buddhists. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, I think it's extremely unlikely that that the attacks on these churches are directly born of Sri Lankan, domestic sort of conflict dynamics.
Ishan Tharoor from The Washington Post, anything to add to that?
No, absolutely. I would contend that what shocked so many people when this happened was that there was no implicit understanding of any kind of conflict dynamics between Muslims and Christians, certainly something that would justify this kind of scale. And among policy watchers here in Washington, the focus on radicalization of Muslims in South Asia has never ever sort of dwelt on Sri Lanka. You're looking, of course, at Pakistan and Bangladesh, but even the nearby Maldives, which is this tiny archipelago nation, has sent many more fighters to ISIS than the Sri Lanka did. So it was never really on our radar in terms of being the next kind of hotbed or target of jihadist activity.
Also joining us now is a member of the Sri Lankan community here in New York, Dedanu Surawira. Dedanu, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm so sorry it's under these circumstances.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me. Appreciate it.
Let our listeners who may not have any idea that there's a Sri Lankan community in New York know a little bit about who you are and where you are.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Staten Island with the Sri Lankan community. My parents came here in the early 80s. I grew up in a predominantly Sinhalese Buddhist community. Right now, the community is really just, you know, still in shock and in grief. Just yesterday, we held a mass memorial at St. Adalbert's Church. It was predominantly, though, a Christian and Buddhist community. And so I really resonate with what the other speakers mentioned, which is that there's definitely a divide. Even though at the Mass it was a beautiful ceremony, and I don't want to take away how wonderful it was to see so many folks together, but also seeing the absence of Muslim leaders and Tamil folks, and I'm thinking, and I say that in the sense of you know, being concerned about the outreach from the Sinhalese community to Tamil and Muslim leaders. There's absolutely a sense of like Sinhalese Buddhist nationalism that is in the community. And so I worry a lot about how this tragedy will really turn into the continued rise of those sentiments and an anti-Muslim sentiment.
And my understanding of the history is that the bloody civil war there, which ended about 10 years ago, had divisions that were more ethnic than religious. And this attack seems explicitly religious in nature. I'm just curious, you know, from your perspective, Data New, how new it seems and different it seems, or how you understand this in the context of Sri Lankan history.
Yeah, it was really devastating to hear. And to me, I can't help but question the story. The story just doesn't add up for me. And I'm thinking about the timeline and how May 18th will come up, the 10-year anniversary of the end of the Civil War. And, you know, just recently last year, the former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, you know, tried to reclaim a position as a prime minister. And his history is very much about supporting the Sinhalese Buddhist nationalist agenda. And so to me, I am questioning some of the details and really who's involved and what kinds of, you know, political play is coming into place and how that's really impacting the Christian community, who I feel like, you know, has been kind of straddled between a lot of the ethnic tensions amongst many of the other religious groups.
Interesting. When you say you question the story, do you question the narrative that's come out from the government that this may have been an act of retribution for the New Zealand mosque attacks?
Yes, I do.
Because of all the domestic politics you were just describing?
Yes, yes. Something to me doesn't add up in what they're saying and who's really involved.
Data New Sura Wira is a member of the Sri Lankan community here in New York City. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes, and good luck to everybody there.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And we're still with Alan Keenan, Sri Lanka senior analyst based in London for the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent war and maximize peace, and Washington Post foreign affairs reporter Ishan Tharoor. Alan, for you as a peace worker, how do we accurately characterize this attack compared to the one in New Zealand or the Tree of Life synagogue attack in Pittsburgh? I mean, if those were terrorist hate crimes based on white supremacist hatred of Jews and white supremacist hatred of Muslims, if we can label them like that, should we see this as an anti-Catholic hate crime fueled by an Islamist extremism? Or based on what we just heard from that member of the Sri Lankan community and other shades of gray, we just can't really label it at all?
Yeah, tough questions. I mean, if it turns out that ISIS is in fact involved if they helped coordinate and train and back up the Sri Lankans who appear to have been involved here, then I think we do need to think of it as part of the ISIS sort of project of dividing the world into the infidels and the apostates on one side and the true believers on the other. And unfortunately, there's lots of other people from other communities who seem to want to do the same thing from the reverse direction. So it does seem to be part of that. I think if that's true, it means that these atrocious attacks are not directly products of Sri Lanka's complicated history of inter-ethnic and inter-religious violence. But I do think it's important to point out that the alienation of young Muslim, mostly men in Sri Lanka, that has been growing and that has been understood and worried over by leaders in the Muslim community, is at least in part a product of the pressure that they've been under for the last 7 years by Sinhala Buddhist groups. And I think also the effect of the war and the the other two big communities, the Tamils, mostly Hindu, some Catholics, and the Sinhalese, mostly Buddhist, but some Christians, both grew more and more nationalist. And the dominant politics were nationalist, exclusivist politics that had really no place for Muslims. And indeed, the Tamil Tigers threw out all the 75,000 Muslims from the northern province during the war overnight. So there was a massive ethnic cleansing of Muslims who were caught between these warring parties. And so I think it's as part of that also, Muslims were more likely to turn inwards and to begin to develop and defend their own identity against these competing nationalisms. So I think that's also has helped sort of further the growing separation of Muslims within Sri Lanka, which I think is then, tapped into and exploited by these global discourses of jihadi violence.
Mm-hmm. And we're getting a phone call from another member of the Sri Lankan community as she's identifying herself, and that is Elle in Brooklyn. Elle, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you. What would you like to say?
So I'm a part of a group of diaspora here in New York that is a diverse group of Sri Lankan activists and individuals who have gathered to set up a vigil here in New York at Union Square today at 7:30. And the vigil is for the victims and the families of the bombings in Sri Lanka. So there is anybody out there who has lost family that is affected by this or just wants to come and support and show their solidarity, please come along. We will be lighting candles and holding space together. It's important to note that I think a lot of people are confused right now. And, I'm not knowing what's really going on. And this is why we're creating this space to create a space for everyone from our island to come together and show support for each other at this time. Because I think everyone is nervous about the political climate of the country and where this could lead to, not just the horrific attacks that have affected us in the last couple of days.
So 7 o'clock at Union Square, you said, right?
7:30 at Union Square.
And are correct. You hoping that people outside the community come too? Because I'm thinking back to the New Zealand mosque attacks when really the gatherings that took place after that were not just to memorialize, but they were also political in the sense of saying, I stand with Muslims against white supremacy. Is there anything like that in support of Sri Lankan Christians here?
Exactly. This is very much for us, a space for us to stand for the communities that have been directly affected by this particular attack, which is the Catholic and Christian community in Sri Lanka because of the very pointed attacks on churches on Easter Sunday. This is also, though, a space to note that we want to create a space here for everybody from our island, no matter what ethnic group you're from. Because the thing is that I think the concerns here is that how this can also trigger ethnic conflict on the island, which is there's just a long history of that. And I think everybody's afraid of a witch hunt, even though, of course, you know, we need to get down to the bottom of what has happened here mm-hmm. so that this doesn't happen again. I am Berger, and I'm from my family is Catholic. So, you know, I had family that was on their way to church that day. And luckily nobody got hurt. But, you know, obviously everyone I know has been deeply impacted by this. But as someone who is Catholic and who has come from Sri Lanka and has grown up there, I don't want to see what we saw happen in the past in terms of the attacks on whatever community, whatever group has caused this. I don't want to mm-hmm. see a recurrence of
a cycle of violence. Right.
A cycle of violence and profiling. You know, that's what's I think most scary for us.
Elle, I'm gonna leave it there, and I really appreciate you chiming in and announcing the memorial at 7:30 at Union Square tonight. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We've just got a minute left, and Ishan Tharoor from the Washington Post. An editorial in the New York Times today is about how social media, especially Facebook, has been adding new generational fuel to old sectarian fires still smoldering after that past civil war that ended 10 years ago, and says on a larger scale, this should add convincing weight to demands that the social media companies block the venom that they allow to spread. We've only got 30 seconds left in the show, but can you add anything to the role of social media in this attack that might have made it different?
Well, what happened immediately in the wake of the attack was that the government clamped down on social media platforms, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram. And this was, you know, a justifiable move, but critics also point to the extent to which this is a dangerous move that disables free speech, that traps information in a certain way.
So the tension between free speech and the spreading of hate rears its head again, and that has to be the last word, I'm afraid. Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post, and Alan Keenan from the International Crisis Group based in London. Thank you so much for enlightening everybody on the context.
Thanks to both of you.